Hello, I'm Ernie Smith. This is number 0594, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0594. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actress Dawn Wells, who recently passed away from COVID-19, with part of a conversation we had back in 2001. She talked about the difference between her and her iconic character of Marianne from Gilligan's Island.
I think there's a lot more levels to me than there is to Marianne, but I was raised very similar. I think Marianne is a principled, ethic, hardworking, fair, good friend type young lady, and that's the way I was brought up. I was raised by a mom. My parents were divorced, but my father had a tremendous influence on my life, and I was expected to do things that were good and get good grades and clean up my room and do things like that, you know, good English and good grammar and manners and all of those things, which I think Marianne stands for. I'm more worldly than Marianne. My life is, I've seen more of the world than Marianne has, but I think there's quite a bit of me there.
Sean Peterson is the Pez candy historian and the author of the book Pez, From Austrian Invention to American Icon. As a Pez collector, he actually went to the company and created his own job.
So many companies that manufacture will have a tour, they'll have a gift shop, they'll have a place that you can visit at the factory, they'll tell you everything about their brand and turn you loose in the gift shop to buy things. Pez didn't have that, and I thought, well, there's the opportunity for me. I've amassed this collection for several decades now. I knew enough about the company at that time to know they didn't have an archival collection of their own that would be representative of everything, so I thought that's kind of how I fit with this. You know, maybe it'd be something they would like to do or consider as a way to add to the business.
David Rich is the author of The Mirrored Palace, a spy story that features the real-life character of explorer and author Richard Francis Burton. How much liberty can you take when writing a fictional novel about a real person?
Burton has fans around the world. There have been movies about him, and you've got to deliver on the real guy, but give your own interpretation. So it's quite different than just making up a character out of nothing. It's a lot of fun this way because you have a guy who really did all these things. Burton was an incredible person. He great swordsman, knew 30 languages. All this stuff is true. So then anything you add or change is going to be inspected.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0594, was Ernie Smith from the great newsletter Tedium, the dull side of the internet, which has just celebrated its 6th year anniversary. You can check it out at tedium.co. Ernie has been a guest several times on this show, and his newsletter is a great bi-weekly read. Congratulations, Ernie, for 6 years of great content, and thanks for doing The Guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A 25-year-old Russian man identified as Vasily went out with friends on the evening of December 9th in St. Petersburg when he encountered two women riding a horse through the streets and decided he wanted to pet the horse. He said the rider offered him a carrot to give to the horse, but, he said, the horse turns sharply to me and bites, taking off a chunk of Vasily's nose, then spitting it out. The missing piece was retrieved and doctors were able to sew it back into place, but they expect there will be scarring. Vasily denied the police report of the incident that claimed he was drunk and tried to kiss the horse. Well, I'm guessing that Vasily has finally learned the lesson that nay means nay. An on-duty Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy allegedly had sex with a woman near the Bates Motel area of the Universal Studios lot and somehow left his microphone on during the encounter. TMZ obtained a clip of the incident between the unnamed duo, which was overheard by a female dispatcher. The dispatcher alerted the deputy after hearing a woman moaning and breathing heavily.
95 Ocean, you have an open mic. Oh, 95 Ocean, open mic.
Oh yeah, mic's open all right. It's not clear if the encounter took place in a police cruiser. The deputy was not identified, but he was removed from duty and is being internally investigated, according to department officials, who said there would be a thorough investigation and punishment if warranted. Well, judging by the audio, he was already involved in an internal investigation. You know, for guys looking for a little action, hanging around the Bates Motel has an adverse effect on one's libido and judgment.
Let's just say for the sake of argument that she wanted you to gallantly protect her. You'd know that you were being used, that you wouldn't be made a fool of, would you?
But I'm not a fool.
Well,
and I'm not capable of being fooled, not even by a woman.
Well, this is not a slur on your manhood, I'm
sorry. Let's put it this way. She might have fooled me, but she didn't fool my mother.
Mm-hmm. Police were called to a home in Tijuana, Mexico, to break up a fight that broke out after a man identified only as Jorge discovered a tunnel leading from his home to that of a neighbor, Alberto, who was having an affair with Jorge's wife. Trouble began when Jorge arrived home early from work and surprised his wife and Alberto, a bricklayer who was also married. Alberto hid behind a couch before disappearing down the tunnel, which appeared in photos to be professionally constructed. Well, Alberto is a layer of bricks, among other things.
Get down on your knees in the tunnel of love.
Tunnel of love.
Jorge followed Alberto down the tunnel, eventually confronting him in Alberto's house. Oh, there is so much to unpack here. How both anally retentive and deeply in love or lust does Alberto have to be to build a tunnel? Wouldn't sneaking in and out of the front door or back door or side door or window be easier? How long has this illicit affair been going on? A tunnel isn't something you build overnight, and it does take a certain amount of planning. And a note to Jorge's wife. Does Alberto have tunnels to any other house in the neighborhood? I mean, he's just too cunning to be trusted.
You think of yourselves as really good friends, but you know how it always ends in the tunnel of love.
Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first segment, after a bank robbery in Fort Myers, Florida, police released security camera photos from the bank. Barbara Robolotta was watching the news and noticed that the robber had very, very large hands. Indeed, one witness told investigators that the suspect had Popeye hands. Robolotta told police she thought the robber was her 36-year-old boyfriend, Glenn Aiken, who shortly after the robbery stopped by a tire store where her car was being serviced and paid the $960 charge in cash. Investigators matched that cash by the serial numbers to currency taken in the robbery. Aiken was arrested and allegedly admitted to the robbery. He told police Robolotta had no idea he was going to rob a bank to pay her bill. Well, he's strong to the finish, 'cause he eats his spinach. He's Popeye the Robber Man. I'll bet Barbara's going to miss those, yeah, big hands. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? There was a character that was every boy's crush and every girl's best friend. It was Marianne from Gilligan's Island. The embodiment of that character was brought to life by actress Dawn Wells. Dawn became yet another victim of COVID-19 as she passed away on December 30th at the age of 82. Dawn was a guest on my old radio show back in November of 2001. Here is a segment of that conversation now. Tell us a little bit about Dawn Wells before Marianne.
Well, I wasn't in the business for very long. I'm a graduate of Stevens College, which is an all-women's college, and University of Washington in Seattle with a BFA in theater. And I had a choice to make between to go to Los Angeles or New York. At that point, that was the only two places you could earn a living. And I was pre-med before I went into theater, so I gave myself 2 years and said, I'll see if I get a job. And I chose Los Angeles because there was more work for me. Most of everything in New York at that time was musical comedy. I was born and raised in Nevada, fourth generation. My great-great-grandfather drove stagecoach during the gold rush, so I'm a real Western girl. As a matter of fact, I did a show in your country. I did a show called Dawn Wells' Real Adventures with Kathy Ruddick, a fishing show, fly fishing, mm-hmm. all over the world. Before Gilligan's Island, I worked pretty regularly, never any really small roles, because I think I was really well trained and I was a perfect type. And when Gilligan's came along, I was a replacement, as you know, if you watched the special.
Right.
And I just auditioned and got the role, and boy, that was it. You know, it changes your world.
And we had Bob Denver on this program. As a matter of fact, we had an opportunity to work with him because we did, as part of Just for Laughs, a tribute to Sherwood Schwartz. So I had the opportunity to work with both the gentlemen. That was back in 94. And the thing that's always interesting about talking with Bob is, of course, as you know, he's a well-educated man, a very intelligent man, very articulate man, which, of course, is a lot different than Gilligan. And so I wanted to ask you the similar question. What misconceptions do people have of you because they think you're just Marianne?
Well, I think I'm closer to Marianne than Bob is to Gilligan.
Okay.
You know, I mean, Gilligan is such a buffoon kind of character. I think people are kind of surprised. And Bob isn't really funny. He doesn't have a great sense of humor, as the professor really does. Bob is more of a comedic actor. I think there's a lot more levels to me than there is to Marianne, but I was raised very similar. I think Marianne is a principled, ethic, hardworking, fair, good friend type young lady, and that's the way I was brought up. I mean, I was raised by a mom. My parents were divorced, but my father had a tremendous influence on my life, and I was expected to do things that were good and get good grades and clean up my room and do things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That good English and good grammar and manners and all of those things, which I think Marianne stands for. I'm more worldly than Marianne. My life is, I've seen more of the world than Marianne has. But I think there's quite a bit of me there.
Actually, I want to play a clip from you from when Bob was on the program with us, because you were asking him some questions about being on the show and working with you. And also, somebody was talking about people actually meeting Marianne. And this is the clip he had from when he was on our program.
John Wells and Russ Johnson, we get together like two or three times a year and we get rescued wherever there's a body of water. And it's really fun because we'll be in an airport, you know, and Don will be standing like 10 feet behind me and some young man in his 20s will come up to me and he'll say, "Oh, I really love the show and all that." And I say, "Yeah." And I said, "What'd you think of Marianne?" He goes, "Oh, wow, she was really great, you know." I said, "Would you like to meet her someday?" And he goes, "Oh, boy, oh, let me tell you, that would just be, oh, boy." And I say, "There she is." And the guy just turns red, becomes 9 years old right in front of my eyes, can't talk, feet shuffling.
The three women, I think, who were a big hit with a lot of kids, even though they may have been overshadowed by their more glamorous sidekicks, would have to be Betty from Betty and Veronica.
Right.
Betty Rubble.
Yep.
And Marianne.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the three.
Over the years, they've had contests wherever I go, and, you know, and they even had national contests to see who was, you know, who the guys like the most, Ginger or Marianne. And Marianne always wins like 75 at least mm-hmm. percent. Vote for Marianne.
Your thoughts on that? I mean, you must hear that all the time.
It's sort of become a thing now. And it's actually more of a thing 10 years after the show went off the air than when we were on the air. I think it is, you mentioned the Betty and Veronica. I think it's sort of the old lifelong dilemma between the girl next door and the sex symbol. And I think nowadays the girl next door is fewer and far between. I mean, there isn't any Marianne on television anymore. We're all pretty sophisticated and pretty worldly. You know, anybody over 12 has sort of had a life now, where Marianne was sort of the last of that era, I think, almost. So I think maybe you're holding her more dear because of it. I don't know.
But yeah, I think even when the show was on, people just seemed to gravitate toward Marianne. I'll use a military example. I would think that, you know, Ginger is the kind of person that the guys in the military would love to see on the USO tour and would probably have a pinup on their locker, but Marianne was the girl in their wallet.
I've never heard that before. Well, Marianne's kind of the marrying kind. Or if you're a girl, she'd be your best friend. She would never try to take your boyfriend away or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Marianne would, I always say she would cook and sew, you know. She would do all those things that good little housewives are supposed to do. And yet she'd probably help you plow. and be a lot of fun. I mean, I think Marianne was a symbol of what was good.
You mentioned Marianne, and guys, their knees go weak. What is the
Isn't
reaction?
That wonderful? I'm kind of divorced from that. I mean, I really don't really think it's me. It's awfully nice to hear people say that, but I guess in reality, that's really pretty special.
Yeah.
You know, when you really stop and think about that, how many people in a lifetime go through that? I have people come up and have expressed love for 35 years, three different generations. That's really very special. In this world today, we can use a little bit more of that, you know?
What do the women say? What about girls who grew up with Marianne?
Marianne was their best friend. No, I mean, I got the most fan mail, and it was equal male and female. I mean, Marianne would be your buddy. She'd be your best friend. She was a good role model. There was never that feeling of competition or jealousy. There never was with Jeannie either, I don't think. Barb Reedon had that same effect. Barb Reedon, the girls liked her as well as the guys liked her. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. So I guess it's a character that you are very, very, very proud of having played.
Yeah. I mean, as an actress, I could say I've done a lot more that I could say I'm prouder of, more complex a character to create. But obviously, I've created something that was memorable to somebody, and I don't know that every person would play the character the same way.
Yeah. Another thing that we talked to Bob Denver about is we had something in common, and that is Bob Denver and I are fast talkers. And he said that you're also a fast talker. And here's something he said about that when he was on the show with us 7 years ago.
Extremely fast. She would write, you know, 3 pages of dialogue for us, which is supposed to run around 3 minutes. And we do it in 45 seconds, and the script girl would have to go to the phone and say, "Sherwood, they did it again. We're 2 minutes short."
Was that a problem you guys had on the show?
Well, no, we once had a director that said Bob and I talked in shorthand. We could get a show done in half the time. That is a problem as an actor. It's a very hard thing to correct.
Mm-hmm.
I enunciate well, so you can hear me, you understand me, but if you try to slow down, a lot of your energy goes. It's a challenge as an actor to slow down and still keep the same energy and actions.
The show you did, Surviving Gilligan's Island, which was on CBS back on October 14th, it was such a labor of love. Clearly it was. It's obvious that you enjoyed your role as Marianne. You enjoy looking back at your role as Marianne. Was there a period of time where you wanted to separate yourself from Marianne?
Not really. I think when you first come off the show, you think, all right, you know, now I'm going to go do something else. I went right back to the stage because I was afraid I'd be playing the Mariannes forever. So I went right back to the theater, in which I was trained, and did, you know, Ibsen and Chekhov and Tennessee Williams in addition to Neil Simon and a lot of things, so I would continue to grow and to stretch. But I think no one understood it would go on this long. I mean, we're the longest-running show in the history of television syndication. We've never been off the air since 1964, and we're in 30 languages still. So who would know that? I mean, who would know that you would pick something that would stick with you forever? I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. You want to say, you know, I can do something else. But I have. Maybe as many millions of people haven't seen it as much as have seen Gilligan's. But my artistic side has been not totally satisfied. I still want to continue doing it. But at least I've been working on something besides just playing that character. And I see no reason to deny it. I'm greeted with love everywhere all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those gambles you take when you do a television series.
One of the things that was brought up in the movie, which Bob Denver did mention on the program, but I want to hear your side of the story, was when you went to, was it Samoa?
Solomon Islands.
Solomon Islands.
Yeah.
Share that story with
me. Well, I'm a real adventurer. I have trick knees. I've got Joe Namath knees, so I'm not very athletic, but I'm outdoors. And I've climbed the hills of Rwanda with the mountain gorillas, and five of my college friends from Stevens and the president at the time went to the Solomon Islands. We have 5 women and a National Geographic photographer, and we went to islands that women had never been to before, tourist women had never been to. And we arrived on the island of Sulafu, which is a little island built out on a coral reef. The chief's family had been chief for 19 generations. And as we canoed up, the chief's wife took one look at me and went, "Oh, I know you." And she'd been on the island of Haniara, which is the capital of the Solomon Islands. A big battle in World War II was fought there. And she'd gone to nursing school in the 70s and had come home and watched TV. And now she was on an island with no running water, no electricity. Now I'm fighting in the middle of the Pacific. "I know you." So you can't get away from it, no matter where you are.
Tell me, Don, do you have a favorite episode?
Well, I think as actors, we like to do the guest, dream sequences. I think my favorite episode to do, I think the title of it was the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde one, but I got to do an Eliza Doolittle character playing the Cockney accent, and that was fun. I think one of the best written, I thought, was the Hamlet. The takeoff on Hamlet, I thought, was clever. There was one episode I thought was kind of cool when Roy Calhoun was our guest, and he was the hunter that had hunted every animal in the world.
Oh, yes.
And he wanted to try to hunt a human, and Gilligan was the target. I thought that was kind of funny. Kind of an interesting plot, actually.
Was there ever a time when you looked at a script and you went, I'm not sure about this?
Most of them. Most of them say, well, somebody's surfing on and surfing off and doesn't know where they were. Of course, but that was the fantasy.
Did you have opportunities? I know that Bob had a couple of series that he did after the show went off the air.
I have not, no. Well, I did a pilot for Fan Drescher about 5 years ago, which did not sell. But no, I have not done, I haven't done a series yet.
Would you still like to do another
series? Yeah, oh, I'd love to, and I'd love to do something like The Practice or something. I'd love to do a Law and Order. I love that. I'd love to do a drama. Comedy, of course, is my first. But I'm enjoying the producing end of it. I'm not going to talk about it. I don't want to jinx it. But I've got a couple of projects in the work, which is kind of exciting for me to make that step. I've produced some theater, but I've never done anything in film. I have no desire to direct film at all.
Mm-hmm.
I do in theater, but I just have no desire to make that leap. But producing is fun. I got my hand in everything.
That was actress Dawn Wells, who forever will be remembered as Mary Ann from Gilligan's Island. She died on December 30th at the age of 82. I have to admit, this one stings a little more than others. I had the pleasure of talking both on and off the air on several occasions with Dawn. She was a very, very special person. Plus, her publicist, Harlan Bohl, has been a good friend both to me and this show and my previous show for over 30 years now, so I know he's been hit hard by this one as well. Add the fact that she was yet another shining light that has been dimmed due to a pandemic that certainly didn't have to reach these proportions. It's just mind-numbingly frustrating. Anyway, Patreon Stuff File patrons can hear the full conversation with Dawn Wells by going to our Patreon page. And if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. I also urge you to go to our website at thestufffile.com to look up show number 0172 from December of 2012 for a more recent conversation with Dawn. You can play that right off the webpage for that show. As a matter of fact, you can check out any of the guests from any of our previous shows, almost 600, going back to all the way to 2009, as the website has been revamped and updated. So check that out at thestufffile.com.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the Pez historian plus author David Rich and his new novel, The Mirrored Palace. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can also find it on several radio stations such as WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories. And thanks to all for joining in. Don't touch that dial. Well, a father and son seen fleeing from a burglary in Milwaukee jumped some barbed-wire fence and ran straight into deputies and a canine who was responding to the scene. Shortly after 2 a.m. on December the 8th, an alarm went off at an industrial business. When deputies arrived, they spotted a Jeep in the parking lot with its rear hatch open. The suspected burglars, later identified as 46-year-old Todd Mullins and his 25-year-old son, Austin Todd Mullins, ran away. They jumped the fence and were greeted by K-9 Valley and her handler. Investigators found bolt cutters, a paint sprayer, and tools with a total value of at least $3,000. Authorities said they also found meth. Todd Mullins was booked for possession of meth, criminal trespass, and theft. Austin Todd Mullins was booked on burglary, theft, and identity theft, along with failing to appear on a previous meth charge. You know, take your son to work day isn't always a good idea. Then again, I suppose meth is something that a father and son can do together.
I don't know, Peter. Meth is a hell of a drug.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Then again, the family that does meth together can experience death together.
Oh, for God's sakes, Peter.
Okay, just a thought. Jeez. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, a former Home Depot employee says the company fired him over a tattoo of his ex-girlfriend's name, Isis, a name derived from the fabled Egyptian goddess. The letters of the inner lip tattoo were written in capitalized form, giving it the exact spelling of an acronym used to reference the Islamic State, an army of Muslim extremists. Said Kirk Sikorsko, "I honestly didn't know what the acronym meant until just recently." What? Have you lived under a rock for the last 2 decades? Anyway, while working as a Home Depot tool demonstrator, he was aptly named, in Patchogue, New York, Sikorsko said he overheard the term during a conversation and showed his tattoo to a coworker. Home Depot and the Florida marketing firm that paid Sikorsko fired him soon after. Home Depot spokesman Stephen Holmes told reporters that the termination was a personal matter and the decision wasn't just based on the tattoo. Sikorsko contends that he was not a terrorist and that he got the tattoo 4 years ago. He said he is no longer with the woman whose name is depicted. "I feel a little lost," he said. "It was a good-paying job." Sikorsko is reportedly considering legal action against Home Depot. Well, good luck with that. You know, in a perfect world, I'd like to believe that his ex is a woman who knows her name is modern-day poison, and she gets all of her boyfriends to tattoo it somewhere on their bodies as sort of a time-release self-destruct mechanism. That, and the fact that she's dating clueless dolts. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Sean Peterson has a really cool job. He is the company historian at the Pez Candy Company. He's also the author of Pez, From Austrian Invention to American Icon. Sean joins us on the line from Orange, Connecticut, which is the home of Pez and also the Pez Visitor Center. Hi, Sean.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So many of us have grown up with Pez, but very few people have made it their life work as far as writing a book and running the Pez Visitor Center. So kudos to you for having the coolest job on the planet. I take it you were a Pez fan growing up as a child.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, well, not so much as a child, but maybe later in life, trying to figure out what to do with some spare time and, you know, what am I looking at when I'm going to these flea markets and junk sales, and didn't really have too much of an intended purpose. So I just started picking up Pez, and, you know, the more I got and started to build a little bit of a collection, the more interesting I found them to be, because this is, you know, before anybody had internet access. This is before any books had been published on the hobby. So there was really nothing out there that I could find. This is still, you got to talk to people and put pen to paper if you want to find something out, or call them really to get some information. But who are you going to call and who are you writing to? So, you know, that aspect of it I found really fascinating. And just, you know, the dispensers themselves, I thought, how cool is this? It's just a kind of a little piece of art, the way they work, and the top was kind of intriguing. And you know, I thought, well, I think I've had these when I was a kid, but are they old? Do they go back? You know, and it kind of led one thing to another, and that was 30 years ago, and I'm still, you know, intrigued as I was. There's still things that pop up, people are finding out. So, you know, it's a really interesting hobby that, you know, who knew where it was going to take me so many years ago.
Okay, so it's one thing to have a hobby, but it's another thing to turn it into a career. How did you make that leap?
Trying to keep myself employed, basically. You know, it was one of those things. I grew up and was raised in Kansas City. Hallmark Cards is headquartered in Kansas City. So I got lucky early on and got a really good job at Hallmark. You know, unfortunately, that business isn't what it used to be. And there was, you know, changes being made internally and shifts and so forth. And at one point, about 14 years into that career, I was downsized and forced to look for another job, which I was fortunate enough to find and managed to stay with the company another 6 years. But that was kind of the writing on the wall for me, so to speak, that this probably isn't going to be where I retire at this point, and I better find something to do for the remainder of my career. And, you know, people say all the time, you know, if you got to work for a living, you might as well do something you love. And for me, it was Pez. And what is that? You know, they've already got a factory. They've already got a business. How do I become part of that without just going to say, can I have a job here? Is there something I could do? So I kind of took a page from other playbooks. You know, it's not necessarily an original idea, but so many companies that manufacture will have a tour. They'll have a gift shop. They'll have a place that you can visit at the factory. They'll tell you everything about their brand and turn you loose in the gift shop to buy things. And, you know, Pez didn't have that. And I thought, well, there's the opportunity for me. I've amassed this collection for several decades now. I knew enough about the company at that time to know they didn't have an archival collection of their own that would be representative of everything. So I thought that's kind of how I'd fit with this. And, you know, maybe it'd be something they would like to do or consider as a way to add to the business. You know, we'll get a retail aspect to it. And I proposed the idea back in 2004. No, it was actually 2006. I came up, got a meeting with the CEO and proposed the idea and gave him some random facts and figures of why this would and should work. And he liked the idea, but really wasn't in a place business-wise to go forward with something of that large a scope. So we kept in touch for a few years, and I got a call and said, look, if you're really serious about doing this, let's talk some details. And I ended up packing up everything I had, the collection and a household worth of stuff, and moving 1,200 miles from the Midwest to the East Coast. And this was my project when we started. It didn't exist, and that was my task, was to let's get a general contractor, let's find people to fabricate this stuff, and let's make it work. And I've been lucky enough to be that guy, and now that we're up and running, I'm the guy that gets to manage it all. So I feel really fortunate, because, you know, I get to come to work, and it's my collection that's kind of the foundation of what we're doing here. So I get to play with my toys all day and get to share it with people on a daily basis.
So when people come to the Pez Visitor Center, what are the jewels in the crown as far as you're concerned? What are the things that are the must-see when people visit?
The obscure stuff for me. Everybody loves the dispensers, you know, but the dispensers were the items that tended to be saved more than anything else. So for me, if it had Pez on it, I collected it. It wasn't just a scope of dispensers or anything like that. If it was historical and had something to do with Pez, I bought it. So I've got vending machines, which most people haven't seen or weren't aware of, but there was actually Pez-branded vending machines that used to be around. We've got examples of those. I've got some original outfits from the 1950s and 60s that the models would wear to help promote the brand. And those are incredibly rare. You know, to find a complete outfit is almost non-existent. And we've got several of those on display. Some of the original advertising and photographs and things like that. To me, that's the coolest stuff, just because it's the most obscure. It tells the history of the store or the brand more so than just the dispensers. So it really is all encapsulating. And to me, that's what makes it the most fun, because it's everything.
I grew up with Pez, and I enjoyed the candy, still do, as a matter of fact. And I came across a story that was in the Smithsonian Magazine in December that talked about the company and its history, and talked about your book, which is Pez, From Austrian Invention to American Icon. And it was a fascinating piece, which led me to wanting to find out more about it, which is why I'm talking to you right now. I guess the biggest surprise a lot of people would have, even if they know a lot about Pez, is the fact that it was actually started as a mint to help smoking cessation, correct?
Yeah, that's 100% correct. Yeah, that's really the way it started, and it actually turned into a successful product with that model. You know, a lot of people don't realize we're an Austrian company. We've been around since 1927 when that actually happened. And, you know, it was the success throughout Europe and other parts of the world that continued with the brand. And it wasn't until the introduction to the United States in 1952 that kind of really shifted Pez to what it's known today as primarily a children's product. And kids generally don't like the strong flavor of peppermint. So that was one of the big hurdles when it did come to the U.S. because they were still marketing as they had throughout the rest of the world as a smoking cessation. And Americans really didn't want it. You know, they said, you know, we're fine. We don't need this product. And it didn't really meet sales expectations at all. So somebody in marketing had a brilliant idea to take the peppermint flavor and turn it into fruit flavors and shift the marketing from adults to children. In doing so, they added the little three-dimensional cartoon character head to the top of the dispenser. And that's really what gave the brand staying power and really took off, not only here in the United States, but it actually shifted marketing globally for the company. Once they saw the success here, they kind of shifted that direction. And we've been primarily a children's product ever since.
Now, I remember when I grew up, I had Pez dispensers. The first one I got was a Popeye one. Then I got a Mickey Mouse one and a Batman. What are the most successful through the years? And what's the most iconic one at this time today?
Well, you mentioned one of them, Mickey Mouse. You know, that's been an evergreen for us for decades now. It was one of the early licenses that we were lucky to acquire, work with Disney, create their characters. Disney, as you know, has been buying up a lot of these different companies. They now own Lucasfilms, which is Star Wars, and some of the other major franchises. So really, a lot of these characters, you know, if you look at Disney, that is probably the biggest license that we've done characters for over the years. I mean, there's just dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of different ones, and you factor in the variations, and the number goes up dramatically on that. So that's been tremendously successful partnership with us. And, you know, if you want to look at just a single character that's been great, you know, for us, you know, the time of year is perfect because it's Santa Claus. You know, year after year for many years now, that's our number one selling dispenser year in and year out is Santa. So, you know, we kind of get to pick the look of Santa. You know, every couple of years we'll do a refresh and decide what Santa's going to look like for the next couple of years and roll that out. And you can imagine how many we sell year after year. It's just millions and millions of Santa dispensers. So from a business standpoint, he's our number one guy.
As a collector, they're probably like your children, and they always say, you know, you're never supposed to mention who your favorite child is, but I'll ask the question. Do you have a favorite Pez dispenser?
Yeah, I mean, not a single one. I mean, it changes all the time. Sometimes I really get intrigued by different ones. One of the early ones for me was the full-bodied Santa Claus, and he's from the late 1950s. And what makes him unique is, you know, when I said full-body Santa, he has the full body to him, all the way down to the boots, the coat, you know, the head, whereas, you know, a traditional dispenser is just the head and the stem. And it took me a long time to find my first one. And the first one I found was at a flea market, and I was quite surprised how small it was. And, you know, because I'd only seen pictures of it at this point in a book. And I thought, oh, my God, this is just so cool. This is way better than what I thought it was. And I've been picking them up ever since. And I think I've got like 47 of them at this point, just because I think it's so cool. And they make a nice little display in mass. You just put a whole bunch of them out there, and it kind of gets people's attention. So he's been my favorite for a long time. And then in the late 70s, we did a rubber head dispenser that there was three different versions of, a Disney, superheroes, and then some monsters. And the monsters I've really got a liking to here of recent, because each one's was painted by hand, so there's really no two exactly alike. There's some variations in them, and I've kind of enjoyed collecting the variations of those, and I think I have about 15 or 20 of each different one on display down there, which is kind of fun for me.
Well, we've got less than a minute, so I got to ask you one very, very quick question, and that is, what is a highlight of either your own collection or the Pez Visitor Center that is not a Pez dispenser?
Oh, man. It kind of goes with the Pez dispenser, but maybe our autograph case. I think that's kind of a highlight for me. Any notable people that have come in, actors, musicians, local news people, our governor, things like that. Whoever comes in, if they get recognized, we ask them to pick out a favorite Pez dispenser, and if they'd be kind enough to autograph it for us, we'll put it on display. So that's kind of a fun thing for me. We've got a little celebrity case of different people that have been in, and I think that's kind of a fun aside to what we're doing.
People can find out more information by going to pezcandyinc.com. That's pezcandyinc.com. And, of course, your book is Pez, From Austrian Invention to American Icon. Sean, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Hey, I appreciate you having me, and thanks for your interest.
Sean Peterson, the company historian at the Pez Candy Company. He runs the Pez Visitor Center and is the author of Pez, From Austrian Invention to American Icon. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0594, and you'll find links to the Pez site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order Sean's book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Incoming subspace signal.
Time to check the mailbag. Got some nice shout-outs for last week's show. Our annual Best Of program. Robert J. Steele, a listener from day one and a Patreon subscriber, writes via email, I just listened to number 0593, the Best Of show. We have a slight disagreement on the content, although I suspect that you were thinking of time constraints. My version would have been 52 hours long and simply playing episodes number 0542 to number 0592 in a continuous loop. Well, you could do that, Robert, right on the new and improved Stuff File program website. Give it a try and get back to me and say about 53 hours. In the meantime, thanks for your ongoing support. And Jackie Jordan out of L.A. also writes via email about the year-ender show. She said, the Alison Arngrim interview was one of my all-time favorites. Thanks, Jackie. Talking to Alison is one of my all-time favorite things to do. She's always a delight to have on the air. And that's the mailbag.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. The best thing since sliced bread. No loafing here.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of The Stuff File program, a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. We'll get to that to close things off. We don't have time for any more Stuff File news because we went a little long here on this show, but we do have time for our last guest on the program. David Rich is the author of The Mirrored Palace. It's his third novel. This one is a spy story that features the famed explorer and author Richard Francis Burton. David joins us on the line from Connecticut. Hi, David.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, as I mentioned, this is your third novel. Your previous two were stories involving Lieutenant Raleigh Waters, which was modern-day novels. But this one, you've decided to go back into history and also use an historical figure, an actual living, breathing historical figure. Is that a different mindset when it comes to writing a character when you know you're dealing with someone who is real?
Oh, very much. You know, Burton has fans around the world, and there have been movies about him, and you've got to deliver on the real guy, but give your own interpretation. So it's quite different than just making up a character out of nothing. There's a lot of fun this way because you have a guy who really did all these things. When you make up Lieutenant Raleigh Waters, you say, well, he does this and he does that, and it is, you know, but I could say anything. I could say he could fly. But with Burton was, you know, an incredible person. He great swordsman, knew 30 languages. All this stuff is true. So then anything you add or change is going to be inspected.
What led you to this character in the first place?
Years ago, there was a BBC series called White Nile, based on Alan Moorhead's books about Burton. And I've been fascinated. That was college days, and I've been fascinated by Burton since then. So I was searching around always for a way to tell his story. They made a movie. He found the source of the Nile was his most famous adventure. So there's a movie about that, and I think there's another movie about Burton. There's other BBC series, and so he stuck with me and stuck with me and stuck with me for years. And it wasn't until I came upon, well, this book is about the Hajj, when he disguised himself as a Pakistani Muslim and went on the Hajj. It was great danger all the time, but it was still looking for a handle. He had, before all this, translated the 1001 Nights, we call the Arabian Nights. And loved that book as a kid. So how could I get at Burton? And then I saw he had fallen in love with a Persian woman. And when her parents discovered the affair, they'd killed her.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, man, this happened to the guy who translated the 1001 Nights and was the greatest adventurer of his era. How do the two things fit together? And then that got me going to write the book.
You mentioned that he has been depicted in films in the past, and that leads me to another part of your life. You have written television and films. You wrote the movie Renegades with Kiefer Sutherland and Lou Diamond Phillips. You've done several shows of episodic television. Is it a different muscle as a writer to write screenplays versus novels?
Well, it is. And I didn't get to novels till late. I thought it was beyond me for a long time. I have a master's degree in English, which they say is, you know, teaches you just enough to know how ignorant you are. So I was intimidated about novels for a long time. But I finally had a story, the story, you know, the Raleigh Waters story, Caravan of Thieves, that I thought was a story that was worth telling, but it was going to be a hard sale for the movies. Just as it is, unless it was first a book. So I tried it. If you're a trained screenwriter, a lot of them, maybe there should be more of them this way, you learn structure is first. Structure, structure, structure. People think of movies as, oh, dialogue. But it's not that. It's where the pieces fit. You make the pieces fit right, you have a chance of having a good movie. So when I came to writing a novel, that's, of course, how I approached it. It worked for me. I mean, I think is a good approach, whether it's for screenplays or for novels. But then with novels, of course, you have to deliver in other ways. You can say in a screenplay, furnished apartment, West LA, and you don't have to say another word. You don't have to talk about the couch or the bad oil painting or, you know, the crummy curtains. You don't have to do any of it. But in a novel, you've got to deliver on the location. You've got to deliver on the entire mood and feeling so much more.
Whether it's the fictional Lieutenant Raleigh Waters in your two books, Caravan of Thieves and Middleman, or whether it's Richard Francis Burton, you seem to be highly interested in spies.
Very much. Every story is a spy story to me. So I gravitate towards spies and spying. I like to read about them. And it's what everybody's thinking in some ways sometimes is, who is that person really? What lies is that person telling me? What is that person's real goal? So you're talking about people, and then you're just giving them a setting, a world, in which that is outwardly their goal and their approach. But it could be just, you know, the people in your neighborhood. If you think of it this way, think of a movie like Rear Window or Blow Up are two great examples. Person watching other people. They're spying. That's what life is about. Everyday life is about. You walk down the street, you know, who's that? What are they doing? Look at that guy. You're spying. And that's part of the approach to the movies and books that I've written.
I know you've kind of answered this before when I asked about the difference in writing a fictional character versus one that is based in reality. But another way of kind of asking that question is, with both of your main characters, either Raleigh Waters in your other novels or Richard Francis Burton, you have to do a certain amount of research to get their role right in what they're doing. Does it change the research aspect of it when you're dealing with someone who, first of all, existed and also existed in another time? Does that change the research before you even start writing?
Oh, tremendously. It changed the research tremendously. Well, in Burton's case, so Burton went on the Hajj, and as I said, there's danger every day. If he were discovered, he'd have been killed immediately. But he came out of it with a 3-volume journal that was a worldwide bestseller. Incredible details. He gets into the kind of toothbrush you must use, which, by the way, can only have a certain kind of bristles because other toothbrushes might use pig's hair, and that would be not halal. So all these details. And Burton laid them out. But then you have to go in and find other details that don't conflict necessarily with Burton's account. And then his wife wrote a different account of things. Burton's wife was devoted to him on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, as soon as he died, the first thing she did was make a bonfire and start throwing his papers into it. So we lost a lot of material about Burton along the way. But the difference is tremendous. And it's more difficult, of course. Part of the book is set in 1890 in Trieste after Burton's died. It's difficult to research cafes in 1890 in Trieste, so you're going to make them up, that kind of thing. But I like research. It's fun.
So as someone who spent a life as a screenwriter, are you looking forward to having this, The Mirrored Palace, turned into a film?
I am, and I'm hoping you know, others will see it that way, of course. Either a film or possibly a miniseries, because the book has a sort of large sweep to it, and that's how the marketplace seems to be running these days. And, of course, there's quite a few good actors who could play Burton, tremendously good actors who could play Burton. So, yeah, I'm going to be trying to get it out to people in Hollywood soon.
It's interesting that you mentioned actors, and I was wondering, as a writer, either of novels or certainly of screenplays, do you have actors in mind when you write?
Well, I think I started out that way. My wife used to tease me. She'd say, "Everything you write, you say, is for Jeff Bridges." And I said, "Well, that," and I wasn't aware of that, but that's okay because he's tremendous, right? But and I think it sometimes hurts you to do that because you're writing and you think, oh, I can hear this actor, I can hear Robert De Niro saying this, but other people aren't hearing it just that way. And you're better off writing true and honest dialogue and true and honest action. And actors are really well trained. They're better than we think they are. That, I mean, part of it is they make it look so easy. And they get it, and they know what to do with it. So, like, for Burton, I very much stayed away from that point of view. I just wrote Burton the best I could, knowing, you know, if Christian Bale reads it, Christian Bale will know what to do with it without my advice.
Ah, but what if it falls into the hands of Jeff Bridges?
I'll have to tell him he's too old.
The book.
That won't be fun.
The book is called A Mirrored Palace. David, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, thank you again for having me on. This was great.
David Rich, author of The Mirrored Palace. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0594, and you'll find links to David's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A male passenger at New York's JFK International Airport learned a lesson the hard way after officers found a loaded 9mm handgun in his carry-on. In a press release, TSA spokesperson Lisa Farbstein said the agency learned the man's identity and address because he left everything behind when he fled, including his ID and passport. The Brooklyn man was headed to Atlanta. Officials were able to catch his friends and interview them before they boarded the flight. Said TSA's Federal Security Director John Bambury, "Fleeing the checkpoint does this man no good. It was foolish of him to run. We know who he is, and he now faces a stiff financial federal civil penalty." According to the TSA, the first time a passenger is caught with a loaded gun at a security checkpoint, they can face a fine of $4,100, though that sum can triple depending on the circumstances and the suspect's level of cooperation. I'm guessing that running isn't cooperating. I mean, why? Oh, why? Would you think that bringing a loaded gun onto a flight would be a good idea? Then upon being caught, your first thought is to run, leaving all of your belongings, including your ID, passport, and the friends you're flying with behind? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0594. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0594. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.